As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
If you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, now's the time with our best offer ever. Sign up today and you'll pay just £1 a month for the next 6 months, giving you unrivaled insight and analysis of everything Euro 2020 and taking you well into the new Premier League season too. The Athletic is the only place you can read pieces by award-winning writers like Michael Cox, Rafa Honigstein, Amy Lawrence and Daniel Taylor. And when you subscribe, you'll also get ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts from across its audio network. Head to theathletic.com/totally and become a subscriber today for £6 until the end of the year. That's theathletic.com/totally.
Good afternoon, passengers. This is a pre-boarding announcement for flight 89. Please have your boarding pass and identification ready.
Baku, Sevilla,
Amsterdam,
Glasgow,
München,
St. Petersburg,
Bucharest,
Budapest,
Copenhagen,
Roma,
London.
Unbelievable!
Totally Football Show at the Euros, and it's so long Scotland as classy Croatia clip Clark and co. Meanwhile at Wembley, as crypto crashes, Sterling soars. Plus we look ahead to Wednesday's games with more groupie action than a Motley Crue autobiography, and we find out for whom F means failure on this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hello again, listener, it's me, Matt, back with you. Daniel Storey's also on board. Hi, Daniel.
Hello, Matt.
And so too, Tom Williams. Now, Tom, Wales' second most famous fan, Ellis James, tweeted yesterday, Wales v Denmark in Amsterdam on Saturday. I can't believe we're now globally recognised as the bad guys. How do you feel about your newfound status as international villain?
Hi, Matt. Yeah, it's quite the turnaround. I mean, we were the fairy tale at Euro 2016, perhaps the co-fairy tale along with Iceland. And we are now the team setting out to try and ruin the fairy tale. So it is a slightly different position for Wales to be in. I mean, Denmark, I think, were the one team who Wales wanted to avoid in the last 16. The last time we came up against them in the inaugural Nations League group stage, they beat us quite comfortably in both games. I think Wales would have backed themselves against Finland and Russia. I sort of found myself willing Finland not to concede against Belgium, purely in a hope that Wales would then end up playing Finland, because I think we'd stand a much better chance against them than against Denmark. So yeah, odds are against Wales, and so are all the neutrals in the world.
So that's one of the home nations. The other two were both in action on Tuesday night. Let's find out how things unfolded in Group D.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Ah, the familiar kiss of tournament ennui. Hello, old friend, said Steve Clark, possibly. Clark saw his Scotland team outclassed by Croatia at Hampden Park as the World Cup finalists joined the Euro 2020 party, in the process ordering Scotland's taxi. Nikola Vlasic had Croatia in front early. There was hope when Callum McGregor lashed in an equaliser near the break.
Thanks to McGregor!
Yes!
Lift off!
But Luka Modric and Ivan Perisic demonstrated the difference in class with goals after the restart to ensure Croatia go through in second place.
Now it's with Modric, goal!
What a strike it is! It's vintage Modric, and it's a heartbreaker for Scotland!
Joining us now is The Athletic's feet bar expert, Jordan Campbell. Jordan, it was a good response to going a goal down with that equaliser just before half-time, but in the second half, Croatia really took it away from Scotland. Is that fair?
No, I think that's fair. You know, it's the typical cliche that half-time came at the wrong time for Scotland. Before Callum McGregor got the equaliser, it did seem like Croatia were almost just playing their own game and Scotland couldn't really get near Modric or Kovacic in the middle of the park. But it felt like if Scotland were going to get a goal, it was never going to be from a great chance. It was going to have to be from, you know, an opportunistic moment, and that's what happened. You know, Adams missed one at the back post. McGinn had a header at the back post. He tried to put across, then he scuffed another chance. And, you know, considering the chances they missed in the last couple of games as well, almost felt like luck was not on their side. But when McGregor rifled that in for the edge of the box, Hamden are updating it for the next 5 minutes with a couple of big challenges went in, and the crowd really got behind them. And you thought they might build on this here, but second half, Croatia just came out and played the way they did for basically the first 35-40, and the better side won in the day. It was unbelievable to watch Modric strut his stuff. I just thought he was terrific, and Vlasic and Perisic, just guys at a different level on the night. So don't think Scotland can really feel too aggrieved.
Did the absence of Gilmore make that much of a difference on the night, and what did you make of how Steve Clarke set the team up without him?
I mean, it's difficult to say if Gilmore was playing, would he have changed it that much? I mean, you're dealing with Luka Modric here, who can wriggle out of holes like nobody else in world football. So, I was surprised that the way they pressed in midfield on Friday against England was so good. The way that Gilmore and McGregor sat behind McGinn, and he really got after Rice. I thought they would go with the same system, but perhaps because Armstrong isn't as positionally disciplined, isn't quite as aggressive as Gilmore, they sort of went with a flat three. But I wasn't quite sure what it was they were trying to do to combat Croatia's midfield. Just so much time they had on it, and it never seemed like we were really trying to put pressure on anyone in particular. I thought we really missed McGinn playing on the right side of the three. I thought we really missed his presence and his ability to win second balls and the heart of the midfield. I think that was one of the big problems, and Croatia were really good down the left-hand side as well, up against O'Donnell.
Jordan, when Steve Clarke looks back on this campaign, will it be the Czech Republic match which really cost Scotland? And where does this leave Clarke now in terms of going forward? Is he the man to carry on for Scotland?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Clarke's position's under scrutiny. There's talk of a new contract being in the offing before coming into the tournament. I think the guy who finished the job that Alex McLeish started, getting here after 23 years was the big box had to tick, so he did that. But yeah, looking back on the three games, I think the major regret is the fact that the Czech Republic, the first half especially, they were there for the taking, I think, and Scotland just played I wouldn't say they didn't play to win, I think they did play to win, but they did it in a way that almost avoided risk, avoid the risk of playing through midfield, playing without playmakers, playing without Che Adams, we'll go long to Lyndon Dykes. I found it really frustrating to watch that, because we've got a better squad than that and a more capable squad than that, but I just felt like we never gave ourselves the platform to actually take the game to them and express ourselves. The England game was a complete 180 for that, where we went in and showed great positional tactical discipline, but on the ball, I thought we really took the game to them. So, again, coming into the Croatia game, you would have taken a shootout with Croatia to qualify, but they just proved a level above. So, that is a regret, that if you'd have at least taken something for the Czech Republic, it would have given you that boost. But, easy to look back at it, but I think you did get your selection wrong that night, and, potentially was Armstrong the right option tonight? I don't think there was a perfect option, no matter who you went with. They all had their pros and cons, but Armstrong really struggled tonight. So, I think the England game is a real strong performance, but both games either side of that were disappointing.
Quickly, Jordan, who are Scotland fans going to throw their support behind now?
Let me think. I was going to say anybody but England, but I don't know. probably Denmark. I would say that's, you know, everybody's default choice, I think, after after what's happened there the last 10 days with Ericsson. So I know they're up against another home nation, so maybe that might be controversial, but you know, I think a lot of people have come away with a even more enhanced appreciation of Luka Modric and just what a football player he is. Just an absolute joy to watch. So maybe Modric will be one of those that you come away from and think, I saw Luka Modric run the show, but right now it doesn't feel like that, but I'd probably say Denmark, yeah, Denmark.
Jordan Campbell there, a sad Scotsman, read him only in The Athletic. Daniel, if nothing else, it was nice to see Croatia join the party and specifically Luka Modric.
Yeah, and I can't help thinking that this was kind of the plan all along. I'm sure they'd have preferred to beat the Czech Republic, of course, but Dalic said before the tournament that the England game felt like a bit of a free roll of the dice for Croatia because they weren't expected to win the game, and they knew with the format of the tournament that there was no huge issue with finishing second or third, and that should still be well within their grasp. And other than the slight setbacks in conceding against Czech Republic and Scotland, they pretty much did that. They're not an exciting team to watch, and that's true of a number of teams in Group D, I think. But you know, they've ended up obviously finishing second because of scoring the extra goal as well. So they'll consider that job well done.
Have we underestimated them, Tom? Have they done that thing that we've been asking teams to do and peak at the right time?
Potentially. I mean, it feels like this group phase has helped Zlatko Dalic figure out what is his best team. When we were previewing a tournament, we talked about Croatia. There was a lot of focus on the players who'd moved on since the last World Cup and the new players potentially who were going to come in. There was talk of Nikola Vlasic, there was talk of Petkovic, and it took until the third game for them to start for Croatia at this tournament. Vlasic, big expectations, young, exciting attacking midfielder, and he came into the starting 11, got Croatia's first goal. But of course, what we've also seen is that you can still rely on the wise old heads of Luka Modric. I mean, possibly the archetypal Luka Modric goal tonight. I mean, a footballer who uses the outside of his foot more frequently and more distinctively than almost any other player I can think of, you know, scoring an absolute beauty with the outside of his foot, and then also setting up the third goal for Ivan Perisic. So yeah, I think Croatia are probably slightly closer to where they need to be than they were in that first match. I think what we saw in that game against Scotland was perhaps an indication that there is a way of sort of balancing the wise old heads with some of these new players. And you know, we talk a lot about momentum. There's a lot to be said for saving your best performance in the group phase for your third match, because it means that everyone goes into the last 16 with a bit of energy behind them, a bit of wind in their sails. If Croatia had started like that and then trailed off, things would be very different. So yeah, I think they'll definitely be one to keep an eye on from now on.
So Croatia go on to play the team who will finish second in Group E, which we will know this time tomorrow. That game will take place in Copenhagen on Monday tea time. In the other game in Group D, England confirmed their place as group winners after Raheem Sterling, who'd never scored at a major tournament before this one, got his and England's second goal of Euro 2020.
Grealish. Oh, lovely little ding. Ball is put into the back of the net by Raheem Sterling. And England lead the Czech Republic by a goal to nil inside 12 minutes.
Came early on. Not a great deal happened after that. Daniel, what did you make of the starting 11? Jack Grealish was the headline maker, I guess, and he set up the goal. Did he do much after that?
Not really. England didn't do much after that, really. I think it was a really good start, and Southgate will be really pleased that, you know, the goal came from Bukayo Saka dropping deep to pick up the ball and surging forward. Harry Kane playing it to Grealish. Grealish crossing, albeit with the aid of a slight nick off a defender to Sterling to score. They were the three attacking midfielders he wanted to choose behind Harry Kane, and it worked really well despite the now overwhelming clamours for Jadon Sancho to start. He's kind of replaced Jack Grealish. And I think what we noticed is that England were better. They were quicker. They had more intent. Luke Shaw was certainly playing higher up the pitch, but I think the Czechs were more dangerous than Croatia or Scotland had been, you know, especially down that right flank with or England's left, where when Shaw was pushed up, that I think most of their play in the first half came down that flank, and I think that made Southgate go back to type, which is the control. And I think the control is just as successful. You know, Czech Republic didn't have a shot on target in the second half, and that's the way to manage a football match. The issue for Southgate, if he believes it to be an issue, is that fans don't see those two successful ideals as being equal to one another. They see that, you know, the attacking intent as a more wholesome way and a more enjoyable, understandable way of watching England in a tournament. So, yeah, I thought England were brilliant at what they did in both halves. It's just that the kind of overwhelming narrative in terms of public opinion, I suspect, will be that they played well in the first half hour and that's it.
Yeah, quite sort of Sven vibes about that, I guess. Mm. Tom, you're a bit more detached than the rest of us from England. What's your take on this Jadon Sancho business then? Because it now seems that he's behind not only Foden, Mount, Grealish, Rashford, but also Saka.
It is puzzling because over the last two or three seasons, he's been one of the best attacking players in the whole of Europe. And you would have thought that consequently the England manager would be doing everything he could to try and find a way for him, if not to start every game, then at least to feature more regularly. So the fact that he got, 6 minutes at the end of the game today was slightly curious. At the same time, as Daniel says, England felt like they shifted into game management mode with about an hour of the game to go. You know, all of the substitutions they made prior to Sancho coming on, which was actually just a like-for-like swap for Saka, felt like game management substitutions about just, you know, keeping in control of the game. And as Dan says, they did that very well. I suppose that the one thing that you could say in Southgate's defence is that in all his appearances for England so far, and okay, he's still a very young player with only a handful of caps, but Sancho hasn't ever done anything in an England shirt that's made you think he absolutely deserves to be starting every single week. And while you can point to his club form as clear evidence that he's good enough to play for England, I suspect that's probably one of the reasons why we haven't seen more of him in an England shirt. And at the same time, you know, we've only just reached the end of the group phase. There is still enough time in this tournament for Jadon Sancho to make a big impact. That being said, I do find Southgate's reluctance to use him slightly puzzling.
I think it was more surprising not to see him come on against Scotland when England were clearly struggling than it was for him not to start against Czech Republic, not least because, as Tom said, he hasn't really performed in an England shirt yet. And also because Southgate picked Bukayo Saka, not least because Saka was facing Jan Boril, who of Slavia Prague, who Saka gave a torrid time to in the Europa League this season. And I mean, Saka was awarded man of the match. Now, whether you agree with that or not, that's certainly some vindication for Southgate's call. I agree it would have been nice to see more of Sancho so far in this tournament, and it would be nice that if we weren't going into the knockout stages with him still kind of this almost hanging over Southgate that he hasn't used him. But I think it was a brave call by Southgate picking Saka, and not least because he wasn't even guaranteed for the squad in, you know, a month ago. So to have him be man of the match, I hope at least kind of dissuade some of that noise for now.
How do you feel now, Daniel, about England having finished top? The argument for is that they get to play at Wembley. It's kind of difficult because we don't know at the time of recording who they're going to face. But as Rory was saying last night, would it not have been better to get the weaker oppo in the last 16?
I'm kind of torn. I think that, I don't know if this is how Gareth Southgate sees it, but England got to a World Cup semi-final 3 years ago. And yet you speak to lots of England fans and lots of certainly almost every England cynic. And the reaction is, well, yeah, but you didn't beat a decent team, even though you got to the World Cup semi-final. Now, that clearly wouldn't have happened if England had beaten Croatia and then lost to France in the final. Maybe they would have still said the same thing. I don't know. But I think it probably made Southgate's mind that his attitude is, look, we want to win this tournament. And if you want to win this tournament, you have to beat these teams. And I'd rather try and do that at Wembley than have to go and move training camp, etc. and so on. He's already got these kind of little issues with, you know, with Mount And with Ben Chilwell, I suspect he didn't want to have to move training camp and fly to another country to play games. So I don't think it was ever really in their thinking.
Tom, Gareth Southgate will say that positives for England were that Harry Maguire started and Jordan Henderson got on. I just wonder how positive that is, because are you going to be then thinking, well, we can start these two players who are definitely going to be undercooked compared to a Calvin Phillips or a Tyrone Mings or whoever it is that they would be replacing? It's got to be a risk to start them in a game against Portugal, Germany or France, surely.
I mean, it's a much smaller risk now that they've got some game time under their belt. I think the bottom line for England is that nothing that has happened in the group phase precludes them from winning the tournament. In actual fact, you know, going through the group phase without conceding a goal, okay, they haven't excited us very much, but they've not really put a foot wrong. And everything that happens to the major nations in the group phase of major tournaments gets magnified out of all proportion. As I said when I was asked on the pod, the only thing that really matters is getting through. You look at the last Euro, Portugal scraped through by the skin of their teeth with three draws. No one was backing them to win it, and they end up winning it. France weren't great in the group stage of the 2018 World Cup. They went on to win it. And England, yes, they haven't been particularly exciting, but it's difficult to play expansive, free-flowing football when you're playing against relatively conservative opposition. I mean, the Czech Republic came at them a little bit more than Croatia and Scotland had. But even so, you know, England will find it, I think they will paradoxically find it easier to play the sort of football they want to play against the big teams like France, Germany, Portugal, because they will have a bit more, because they'll be playing against teams who are more likely to attack them. So as much as it pains me to say it, I don't see anything to worry about from an England perspective. Of course, it could be better, but like, you know, it could have been better for Portugal in the group stage at Euro 2016. And the fact that it wasn't any better didn't stop them winning the thing.
I also think that England under Southgate seem to have got this habit since World Cup 2018 of almost playing down and up to the standards and style of the opposition. So we see these very perfunctory 1-0 wins or even 0-0 draws against teams that sit deep. And then when a team like the Czechs press a little bit more, England suddenly turn up a bit more. It almost seems to depend on the opposition style rather than them imposing their own style, which is probably a criticism of Southgate, but doesn't need to be in tournament football. Because if England do play Portugal, for example, or Germany, and as Tom says, if there is a bit more zip in the game, that probably helps England, because Southgate, all Southgate, I think, wanted to do in this group stage is to stay defensively solid, no calamities, no disasters, win the group. And exactly like Tom says, that we've seen nothing that suggests we can't go deep in the tournament. That doesn't mean we're going to win it. It doesn't mean we all have to get jingoistic about, you know, England's chances. But we also shouldn't. It doesn't need to be this kind of overwhelming, enveloped negativity that for some reason seems to have engulfed Southgate over the last, maybe it's not month, maybe it's come to the fore over the last month, but it seems really harsh to me.
Yeah, and that kind of negativity showed itself a little bit in his pre-match interview with Gabriel Clark. He was asked about the absences of Mason Mount and Ben Chilwell, and he said they spent 120 seconds too long in a fairly open space. It's full of contradictions to me when talking about the protocols that have meant that Mount and Chilwell are in their 10-day isolation. They would be available for the last 16 games, but it's very difficult to see them having any involvement in that if they're not taking part in training sessions for 10 days. Tom, we should have a word on the Czech Republic. They go through, albeit in third place, which is something that they might live to regret, because you feel like playing the second place team in Group E would have been a far easier task for them than potentially Netherlands or Belgium.
Yeah, I mean, you wonder whether that third Croatia goal might prove to be the equivalent of Patrick Kluivert knocking Scotland out of Euro 96 with that late consolation goal against England, in the sense that it felt like a goal that didn't really change very much. But in actual fact, it's the goal that put Croatia second and drops Czech Republic back into third. I mean, I've not been like blown away by Czech Republic, but they're clearly a decent team. I mean, Patrick Schick has been one of the, you know, one of the absolute stars of the group phase. I mean, that goal against Scotland alone, you know, will be talked about for a long time. They weren't far away from, you know, from getting back into the game against England. You think about that Tomáš Souček chance in the first half that sort of grazes the post. So yeah, I wouldn't write them off too quickly, but I wonder whether they may come to rue finishing third in the group rather than second.
So three teams going through from Group D then. We'll turn our attention to the final batch of group games next.
The Euros are here, and we'd better make the most of them because they only come around every 4-5 years. So if your bookie isn't making you feel special, then maybe it's time to find a new one. Yep, not so much carpe diem as carpadium. If the grass is greener on the other side, come and play on it. If your bookie's not giving you the best rewards, switch. And if one leg of your 4-plus-fold bet builder lets you down, get money back as a free bet on all games this Euros. Paddy Power. Pre-match only. Max free bet £10. Excludes enhanced match odds. Min odds 1-5. On exclusive T's and C's apply. 18+. BetGambleAware.org.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Some Euro 2020 related news, which came to light on Tuesday. UEFA has denied a request to light up the Allianz Arena in rainbow colours before Germany's match against Hungary on Wednesday. You may remember that Munich Mayor Dieter Reiter made the request in protest against a new law in Hungary that bans the sharing of any content seen as promoting homosexuality and gender change to under 18s. UEFA says it nixed it because of the political context. Reiter described UEFA's decision as shameful. UEFA have instead offered alternative dates for the rainbow illumination of the Allianz Arena, either June the 28th or between July the 3rd and the 9th. No games happening in Munich on any of those dates. Just do it tomorrow night, lads. Start a GoFundMe. We'll all chip in.
Do it anyway. Yeah. Blame a technical fault. Yeah. Blame a non-existent, you know, work experience kid or something.
It's always that intern.
Foolproof.
Elsewhere, more than 60,000 fans will be in attendance for the semi-finals and final at Wembley Stadium, increasing the attendance to 75% of capacity for each game. How do you feel about this, Daniel? On the one hand, yay, great atmosphere, but also, is this actually safe?
I think it has to be. It certainly has to be safe enough that they are prepared to go with it. I've no doubt that they've agreed to this because they want to keep the semi-final and the final at Wembley rather than it going to Budapest. That seems without doubt. But there are measures in place. You know, this isn't a free fall. It is actually an incredibly admin-heavy process to go through to go to those games, you know, in terms of lateral flow tests, etc. So I on a very personal level, I feel like I'm completely in a little bubble where I've barely left a house in 15 months. So it seems mad to me seeing 3 or 4 people together, never mind 60,000. But I think we have to trust that it is legit and safe, and that there is no kind of spike thereafter. Because that would be obviously be a massive, not a massive shame, but a tragedy.
You see the difference it makes, though, Tom, don't you? That's the thing, the Denmark game on Monday night and the atmosphere that we all enjoyed there. You can see why UEFA is so keen to get that replicated if possible.
Yeah, it makes a massive difference. And, you know, you look at the England game and it felt like one of those very sleepy England friendlies in front of a half full Wembley, partly because it was in front of a less than half full Wembley, and it did have that sort of sleepy, friendly pace to it. And the games that have had, you know, more fans in, that Denmark game being one example, I mean, obviously there's huge emotion around the Denmark team before we even get on to the capacity of their matches. But the Hungary-France game as well, another one. I mean, Hungary, the one home team who have benefited from playing in front of a full house, and you really saw the benefit of that. So, yeah, I mean, from the sort of tournament perspective, from a PR perspective, you can absolutely see why they're pushing to have more fans in for those crucial games at the end.
Wednesday then, the last day of the group stages today as you hear this. What a wild ride it's been. Groups E and F are the last to conclude. Listener, like you, we love this game, but the specific game of Slovakia versus Spain is a tough one to get massively jazzed about, given what we've seen from the two teams thus far in the tournament. Slovakia need a point to confirm qualification. They could still top the group. Spain will definitely be through with a win. It's been a tough task watching Spain so far. I imagine how much tougher it would be if you actually supported them. That's the case for our hombre principal, Alvaro Romeo, who I chatted to earlier. Alvaro, presumably you'll be hitting the caffeine hard over the next few hours so you can stay awake for Spain's game with Slovakia.
Yes, I will. You know, Matt, I never thought that Spain was going to get to this point of the tournament with such a skint return of points, only two. And yeah, they've got everything to do for the last day because you know, they know that they will go through if they beat Slovakia. But of course, with the draw, they might not go through if Poland beat Sweden. So yeah, it's a tricky one.
After the Sweden game, we said, well, it's only one game, and then Spain laboured again against Poland. The reaction in the Spanish press has been fairly predictable. How much pressure are they putting on Luis Enrique and the players?
Well, I think that there is pressure. I think that there is pressure on Luis Enrique, on the players as well, even from some unusual suspects as well, like, for example, Rafael van der Vaart, who was saying that Spain had been terrible, and when the Spanish players have been inquired about that, or Luis Enrique, well, you could tell that they didn't like this kind of remarks from a fellow former footballer, to the point that Sergio Busquets was saying something like, I could be very nasty with Van der Vaart, because if you remember, he was involved in the sequence of Iniesta's goal in the World Cup final against the Netherlands. But yes, the pressure is massive. The pressure is big, and probably Spain is going to face the usual problems that they are facing nowadays. Number one, they have to attack a very populated defense while being patient, but having an eye in the stopwatch as well. Because the more the nil-nil lingers in the scoreline, the bigger the pressure for the team, of course.
Yeah, those quotes from Rafael van der Vaart, he said, Spain is awful, awful. I hope we face them. They have nothing in this team. They just go from one side of the pitch to the other. They don't even have a player who knows how to make a decisive pass. Thiago Alcantara strikes me as a player who knows how to make a decisive pass. Is there any chance we'll see him in this game? And what about other potential changes to the team?
Yes, there is a chance, Matt. I remember we spoke a couple of days ago and I was telling you that I wasn't expecting big revolutions. Well, maybe this is not exactly a revolution, but according to the training session today, Luis Enrique has done a test with Azpilicueta, Gaya instead of Jordi Alba, and Thiago Alcantara in the lineup. So these three could feature in the game against Slovakia, and I think that they've got a decent chance of playing. And Thiago Alcantara is going to be so important in the team because I was checking some stats about the Spanish national team, and you know, collectively, they haven't been that terrible if you check the stats. I mean, they are the third team in the whole Euro with most attacks started, also the ninth in shots on target, the seventh in corners taken, and their XG is more than five, and they have played only two games. But the thing is that individually the executions have been so poor, Matt, because when they have the chances, they haven't scored. And I think that what epitomizes all this is Gerard Moreno's penalty miss against Poland the other day. The team is lacking so much leadership that after Gerard Moreno missed that penalty, basically they couldn't recover from it.
All right. Finally, Alvaro, I'm going to ask you to give us a prediction. Are Spain going to win the match, and are they going to go much further than the last 16, even if they do get through?
I genuinely believe that Spain is going to go through for all the problems they've got that I explained before. I think that this time they have to beat Slovakia, and it's down to them and it's in their hands, and they will do it. I really genuinely believe that it's possible to do this. And then in the last 16, it's a mystery for me, because for the first time, probably Spain are going to face a game in which they are playing against a rival that don't park the bus. And then we will see a version of Spain that we haven't seen before. But in the last precedents of Spain playing against top teams, normally they haven't lost. And a good example of that is that they qualified for the Nations League Final Four. I think that the last 16 is a totally new dimension for Spain, and I wouldn't like to go more far or to do predictions on this. I can tell you that I think that I'm very positive that Spain is going to beat Slovakia.
Muy bueno. Gracias, amigo.
All right. Thank you, Matt. Muchas gracias.
Alvaro Romeo there. Spain topped the possession table, 72%, joint third for accuracy, seventh for attempts on goal. Tom, if you were to release an updated version of your book, Do You Speak Football, still available now, would Alvaro Morata have his own entry slash section?
It's possible. I mean, it does feel like his career is heading in that direction. He has become this sort of eternal nearly man. And it was interesting that after that game against Poland, there was more focus on him, or it felt like there was more focus on him missing the rebound from a penalty that a teammate had missed than on the fact that he'd scored Spain's only goal with a, you know, quite crafty bit of 6-yard box movement. But yeah, I feel like he does sort of sum up Spain's problems in the sense that, as you say, they've dominated both of their games so far. I mean, their XG figures are actually pretty decent, you know, compared to other teams in the tournament, even teams that have comfortably outscored them. But they just haven't yet found that cutting edge. And that's why they find themselves in this real position of peril, basically needing to win this game in order to be sure of going through. I thought Gerard Moreno, who came into the team for that game against Poland, did give them a little bit of an extra spark, sort of playing out on the right, cutting in onto his left foot, sets up Morata's goal, but then misses the penalty that would have given Spain victory. And as Alvaro says, you know, it looks like Spain are gonna shake things up. They've not been that far away from, you know, winning both of their first two games. So I would have thought that, you know, although they're in a very delicate situation, the underlying statistics suggest that if they produce the same performance in this game as they did in their first two games and just show a touch of extra quality in front of goal, that they should be able to win this without too much trouble.
Spain's record against Slovakia, 1-4, drawn 1, lost 1. Luis Enrique played and scored in the first ever meeting between them, as did a man called Samuel Slovak. Abby thinks that's a fake name. It's certainly from the A trialist school of fake names, if so. Daniel, Slovakia only need a draw. They're going to park the bus here, just like they did against Sweden, aren't they?
Yeah, 100% they will. And you cannot blame them for that, having seen how Sweden managed to frustrate Spain. I don't think they'll do it. I think Spain will eventually, you know, it almost, because of how they've played in this tournament, almost just becomes an extension of their other matches. And you have to think that having scored one goal in 180 minutes with that kind of dominance, at some point, the dam will break. That's certainly Enrique's view. He says, you know, we're about to explode at this tournament, which, I mean, maybe he would say that, but it's hard to doubt it against a team who, they're obdurate, but they've still conceded two goals already, Slovakia, so they're not perfect. And yeah, I think Spain will have too much, which will leave Slovakia in a pretty tricky position qualification-wise.
Well, elsewhere in Group E, it's top against bottom in St. Petersburg, Sweden taking on Poland. The Swedes already through, having earned 4 points from their two games. They'll top the group if they win here. Just the 1 point thus far for Lewandowski and co. A victory here sends them through. Tricky to really get a read on Poland, Tom, I think. They were better against Spain, having disappointed in their opening game, but that came with the caveat of having a man sent off. It's going to be interesting to see what they do against a team that theoretically you'd think they should be as good as, if not better.
Yeah, I mean, they were really disappointing in that opener against Slovakia. I think most people would have, you know, would have backed them to win that, and then they're up against it right from the off. I thought they did look much livelier against Spain. They had Zvidersky playing up front alongside Lewandowski, who consequently looked a lot less isolated and got his first goal of the tournament. And they were pressing more aggressively than they had in that game against the opening game against Slovakia. I mean, the way that Spain build up invites that. But, you know, Poland showed a kind of willingness to get up there and get in their faces. And yeah, the fact that Lewandowski's now off the mark, that they seem to have a bit more going for them in attack. Sweden already through, so while they might not take their foot off the pedal completely, you know, there isn't quite the same you know, pressing need for them to go out and get a result. So I think Poland will draw a lot of encouragement from the way that they played against Spain.
As for Sweden, Daniel, they're already through, so this is going to be handbrake off, everybody up front, let's do some samba football in a typically Swedish style.
Yeah, yes and no, I suppose, in that it's a weird game, this one, in that some of the last group stage matches have had next to no kind of intrigue on them. But this is interesting, I think, because if Spain score early and look to be going ahead of Sweden. I wonder if Sweden will go for it, because there is a clear advantage to topping the group. You know, you get a run that plays a third place team in another group rather than playing Croatia, and also avoiding the Italy Belgium half of the draw, probably France as well. So it's a really interesting one, in that I think there's like some weird game management that Sweden will have to do. I really hope Alexander Isak scores, by the way, because I think he's probably been the best striker at the tournament without a goal. Really bright outside the area, does the target man stuff well as well, and yet just not quite clicked for him in front of goal. And I think he probably deserves that.
Yeah, he's been excellent so far. English interest in this game too, with Michael Oliver refereeing. The standard of refereeing in this tournament really has been excellent. Listener, drink. Right, that's Group E. We'll preview the Group of F next.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman, host of The England Show, brought to you daily throughout Euro 2020. I'll be joined by writers from The Athletic and special guests to bring you unrivaled coverage dedicated to the England team this summer. So for expert insight into Southgate's squad and post-game reaction to all the games, search for The England Show wherever you get your podcasts or via The Athletic app.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with Matt Davis-Adams.
Germany and Hungary meet in Munich, which, as mentioned, isn't somewhere over the rainbow thanks to UEFA. Germany have gone from no-hopers to one of the favourites to win the whole caboodle after that demolition job of Portugal. Hungary earned a draw against France, but they'll have to do so without their 60,000-strong support this time. This looks like a relatively straightforward Germany win, he said, tempting fate. Tom, I'm not sure we've seen much of Hungary to suggest that without that noisy back in there, they're up to much particularly.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be an interesting experiment to see, you know, how much that affects them, because that has been a huge factor for them previously. You know, they were so close to holding Portugal to a goalless draw in their opening fixture, end up letting in three late goals, which didn't flatter Portugal in the sense that Portugal were the only team who were trying to score any goals, but it didn't really reflect how well Hungary had played. And then I think that, you know, that sort of raucous support from a full Puskas Arena was a pretty sizable factor in the fact that they managed to hold France to a draw last time out. So yeah, the challenge for Hungary is to try and repeat that intensity when they're not playing on home soil in front of a very vibrant and very energised home crowd. I mean, I think what we have seen from Hungary is, you know, a quite clear approach in terms of how they go about these games, with the sort of, you know, the 5-3-2. They're very compact, they're very physical, and, you know, they look to break forward quickly, you know, whenever they turn over the ball. And they did that very successfully against France. And actually, they were reasonably comfortable. There wasn't any great France onslaught towards the end of the game. And Hungary were good value for that point. So while Germany obviously go into this game with fantastic momentum off the back of that great performance against Portugal, and also with this sense that, you know, this new identity that they've been searching for what feels like, you know, the last sort of 4, 5, 6 years, might finally now be coalescing at long last, I think Hungary will back themselves to make this difficult in the same way they did for Portugal and then for France.
Hungary would definitely go through if they won. For Germany, Daniel, they've got to feel like the way the fixtures were scheduled has worked out really nicely for them. Get the toughest game out of the way first, then dismantle Portugal, and then you've got what on paper looks like the most straightforward match to finish.
Yeah, I actually thought before the tournament started they had it the worst way round, particularly after Portugal scored pretty early, because it felt like they could be almost out of the tournament, having played two of the favourites in the first two games, which felt distinctly major tournament like. But yeah, you're right, it's worked out perfectly, with the roaring comeback against Portugal now plays into the Hungary game, and obviously potentially England's last 16 opponents as well. There is a, you know, I know everyone's being a little bit down on England at the moment, but it's not just that we don't want to play one of these massive nations. They don't particularly want to come to Wembley and play England in the last 16 either. So there's going to be a real scramble to try and top Group F on Wednesday evening, which will be yeah, really interesting, because if we assume that, you know, if we assume that Germany do win, and I think they will, really sets up the other game nicely to see if that Germany top the group or someone else.
That other game takes place between Portugal and France. This one looks great. It's going to be played in Budapest. France are through. They'll top the group with a win. Portugal will be in the last 16 if they avoid defeat. Tom, it's been a little while now since that draw against Hungary. What's the reaction been in the French press this week?
I think there's been some concern about certain aspects of France's performance. There's concern that this new-look attack that France and pretty much everyone else had such high expectations for hasn't yet clicked. You know, Karim Benzema is still waiting for his first France goal since his recall. He's now gone four games or three and a bit games without scoring and fluffed at least one presentable chance against Hungary. I think there are also some concerns about some of the defensive aspects of France's performance. I mean, Benjamin Pavard had one of his worst games in a French shirt and has long been seen as a bit of a potential weak link. So the speculation in the French media is that there are probably going to be a few changes for this one. We could see Jules Koundé of Sevilla come in for Pavard at right back. The expectation is that Lucas Hernandez will come back into the team, having sat out for Luca Dean in the Hungary game. And it looks like Corentin Tolisso might come in for Adrian Rabiot in midfield as well. I don't think there'll be any radical change to the way that France play. This is a Didier Deschamps team after all. But if we go back to the last time these two teams met, it was in the Nations League group phase in November. And in that game, Deschamps went back to the sort of lopsided 4-2-3-1 system that he'd used to such success at the 2018 World Cup, and France won a goal from N'Golo Kanté. And that, along with their opening game against Germany at this tournament, is probably their most impressive performance since that World Cup. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a similar sort of system and a similar sort of approach. So yeah, there's no great sense of concern or dismay, I don't think, as far as France are concerned. But there is this, there is an awareness that there are issues that are just starting to simmer, and that if France were to lose again or produce another underwhelming performance, you know, we could find ourselves looking at certain players, you know, with a fairly considerable degree of scrutiny.
Issues bubbling away for France then, Daniel. That might play into Portugal's favour. Also, the fact that they tend to be better when they're up against it a little bit. They can flatter to deceive against weaker opposition, but like playing in these big games, is that too simplistic a take?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I cannot escape from this game is that if we assume Germany beat Hungary, then I just think I think Portugal will be very, very happy with a draw. That would see them finish third and probably end up in a match against the Netherlands in the last 16 and then Wales or Denmark in the quarters. And they would consider themselves favourites for both of those games, having finished third in their group. So I wouldn't be surprised if Portugal kind of sat deeper, particularly having got kind of dismantled by Germany in their second game. I think they'll probably aim to be more defensive and are probably pretty happy with a draw. Whereas France, that would leave France probably in second place with a game against England to come that they might not be too keen on. So I think the onus has to be on France to kind of, even with the changes Tom says, to kind of push forward and look for the winner, because yeah, I just think Santos will be happy to draw the game 0-0 or 1-1 and take a very handy looking third place given the way the draw's opened up.
Really looking forward to that game. Should be a lot of fun. Right, we are nearly done for today, listener. Next, we'll be talking out of our ass. But first, let's get some odds from Paddy Power and head over to producer Ben.
Thank you very much, Matt Davis Adams. I'm on the line with Graham Byrne from Paddy Power. Graham, let's look ahead to the conclusion of Group E then tomorrow. I've got a feeling that Sweden and Slovakia are going to go through automatically and Spain and Poland aren't. Does this make sense to you and the numbers?
Well, Sweden are already through no matter what happens thanks to the games yesterday. So the big question comes, who joins them? The betting for this is Spain are 1-20. The layers have obviously made up their mind that Spain's ridiculous run of bad luck cannot continue. Their possession stats have been ridiculous. They've missed a penalty. Everything's conspired against them. But they think they're going to put that right in Seville against Slovakia. Slovakia are 23-10 to qualify. Poland are 7-5. Slovakia, they after getting that win against Poland, they were a narrow defeat against Sweden. They're on the back foot now. They only need a draw against Spain. That's the good news for them. But the way things are looking, you just can't see Spain's run of bad luck continuing in this one. The other game, Poland have been thrown a lifeline with that late equaliser against Spain. The results have gone their way. They know if they beat Sweden, they are in. They should qualify. So Poland at 7-5 is the betting. If you think Slovakia are going to qualify, Ben, they're the outsider of the three to go in at 23-10.
All right, then let's move on to Group F then, where it's all very exciting. Portugal v France looks like it could be a real cracker. Can you give us the overall here and the first goal scorer markets?
Yeah, overall betting on this game, Portugal 11-4, the draw is 9-5, and France are 5-4. Now, the chips are down in this one. The stakes couldn't be higher because whoever wins this group gets to play a nice third-place team, whereas the runner-up is looking at a possible game in Wembley against England. So you'd imagine that the French are going to want to get business done after that blip in Hungary. The first goal scorer markets, Mbappe is 4-1. Griezmann is the guy I like. He takes all the set pieces. He's starting to do everything for the French. He is into 4-1. Benzema 9-2, and Cristiano Ronaldo, of course, a man you can never write off, a 5-1. They are the main market protagonist. If I was going to have a bet on the anytime market, for me, it would definitely be Griezmann. He scored in the last game. And as I said, he takes all the set pieces. He just hogs that ball. And in around the goal, he is the man, I think, where the value is, because I do think the French, I want to go in here, Ben, and get a result against the Portuguese to win this group to ensure that they have that better fixture in the next round.
The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power. Place a 4+-fold bet builder on any football match and get money back as a free bet if one leg lets you down. Check paddypower.com for more details. £10 max free bet. T's and C's apply. 18+. Begambleaware.org.
You can sign up for a subscription with The Athletic for unrivaled coverage of Euro 2020 in 2021. All the articles, all the podcasts, ad-free, and Q&As with writers. It's only £1 a month for your first 6 months, so head to theathletic.com/totally. You know what to do with that big fat butt. Wiggle, wiggle, wiggle. If you're already a subscriber, you may well have read Yaya Touré's piece, penned with the help of the excellent Ryan Conway, about big bums and why they can be a big help to a footballer. At the risk of being labelled a pound shop, so mix a lot, I've always been a fan of footballers with a prime rump. Yaya feels the same. Let's make a team out of bottom-based players, shall we? Tom, Abby and I spent a great deal of our afternoon on this, but I think that you might trump us. What names did you come up with, please?
Well, I should probably mention that when producer Abby first mentioned that we were going to do this feature, I thought the goal was to build a team of footballers with great bums or just notably peachy bums. So I tumbled down a very different kind of internet rabbit hole for about half an hour until I double checked with Abby and she told me that it was bum puns that we were looking for rather than actual bums. Do you want my 11 or do you just want me to throw out some random ones?
Throw out some random ones, but let's have a few beautiful bums first, just because I'm intrigued.
Okay, I mean, Eden Hazard is the obvious one. It's hard to, you know, to watch him and not notice his bum.
Mm.
Anyone who has come through La Masia at Barcelona knows how to use their bum to fend off an opponent. So your Xavi's, your Sergio Busquets's, your Andres Iniesta's. I feel like Xavi's use of his bum accounted for almost 60% of his playing ability. You watch the way that he sort of uses it to kind of steer people out of the way, and it's masterful. And then sort of like squat, powerful centre forwards, your Romario's, your Sergio Aguero's, tend to be equipped with, you know, a decent sort of power centre in the buttock region.
Can we have some lame puns as well?
That, isn't it? Oh, God. Yeah, so, I mean, there are some of it. I mean, like, you can crowbar the word ass or arse into quite a lot of names. Try to be a little bit more creative. I mean, Christoph Baumgartner, Austria, that's probably quite obvious.
Yeah, I had that one too, yeah.
Davy Klaassen, Jordan Henderson, Andy Robertson.
What's happening,
and yeah. then my... My centre forward is Aris Seferovic. Aris, of course, being
nice
rhyming slang for your bump.
Very good, Daniel. You look disgusted. Mm. Did that prohibit you from taking part in this childishness?
I mean, I was still. I literally did only think of players with big bums. So just wrote down Branislav Ivanovic a few times. But off the top of my head, Nicky Butt, obviously, Burnt Haas, a former Sunderland player. Bring this thing back temporarily to current affairs. Czech Republic had a player called Holes.
I did notice that when I was looking down the squad list. I believe, sadly, that the little accent on the S means that it's pronounced Holesh.
I mean,
so we might have to, have a stewards inquiry on that one.
If I'm being picky, Tom, I've just heard you say the word Henderson, so let's not worry too much about that.
Further fuel for the anti-Jordan Henderson trolls. Sorry, Matt, go on.
Here's the ones that me and Abby came up with a tip of the hat also to Nick Miller, producer Ben, and Abby's husband, Adam. We tried to go for all people who are in the tournament. So we've got Marco Verratti, Francisco Acerbi, Leonardo Bamucci, Gianluigi Donnarumma, Kevin Mbumbu, Ruben Vargas, Aina Sunal. You'll like this one, Daniel. This is my favourite. Keish Damore, yeah?
Keish Damore. Oh, God. I was looking for an opportunity to get Keish Damore into a name. I didn't even think of Keish Damore.
I thought you were going to say Lyndon Gooch just to finish it off.
Not at the Euros. Got to be at the Euros. Like Dedric Boutiata, Yannick Carrasco. What about Aaron Rumpsdale? Topical one from tonight. Bataille Saka. Scotland defenders. Liam Pooper. Jaxi Hendry. Cesar Azpilicueta, and a weak one to finish off, Tony Poos.
I don't think you needed to qualify any of them by saying a weak one to finish. I mean, there's some of those I didn't even know the footballer you were talking about.
Abby's best one, I forgot that. Jerdan Shaqiri.
Shaqiri, nice. I went for Danilo Pereira, similar sort of thing. lest we forget, Georgi Tushchan, Ukraine goalkeeper. Not that anyone outside, right said Fred, uses tush to refer to bums, but it did come up on my thesaurus.com search.
Listener, there'll be none of this when Jimbo returns, and you've only got me for one more night. You will be pleased to know. Let us know your favourite footballing derrieres at The Totally Show. That's all for today, though. Thank you to Tom Ass Williams and Daniel Storr Reary for joining me, but Davis Adams. From all of us here, it's bye for now.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Keep up to date with everything Totally at The Totally Show on Twitter and find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.